Case number 13-7024, Interstate Fire and Casualty Company versus Washington Hospital Center Corporation, doing business as Washington Hospital Center, Green Spring Financial Insurance Limited, appellant, MedStar Health, Inc. Ms. Wolf for the appellant, Ms. Sarp for the appellee.
Just wait for a second. Let's let the... Hard to believe they would leave when they could hear a diversity case. We don't get many of these. We've been looking forward to this one. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. Linda Wolf on behalf of Green Spring. Your Honors, we are here for de novo review of a summary judgment ruling by the district court in which all evidence must be viewed in the light most favorable to Green Spring and all inferences drawn in its favor. There are four reasons why the district court's decision should be reversed. First, under the plain language of the Green Spring policy, Interstate Insured Nurse Hand does not qualify as a full-time or part-time employee and therefore is not a covered insured under the Green Spring policy. Second, if, as the district court found, the term employee is unclear in the Green Spring policy, then the district court was required to examine the reasonable expectations of the party to the insurance contract. It did not. Instead, it defaulted to the common law test for master-servant liability. Third, the district court ignored the specific risk allocation that was negotiated between the hospital and Progressive, the temporary agency, in which the temporary agency agreed to indemnify the hospital for negligence of any temporary nurse that was placed there, and importantly, agreed to procure insurance to insure the nurses that were leased to the hospital. And fourth, this is a case for equitable contribution. The equities in this case overwhelmingly favor that Interstate should provide the insurance for which it was paid to provide. Now, as to the first two points, as the insurer seeking contribution, Interstate had the burden to prove that Nurse Hand, the Progressive leased employee, was an insured under the Green Spring policy.
Was she an employee?
She was an employee of Progressive. She was not an employee of the hospital. That was specifically stated in the staffing agreement. And the staffing agreement had several terms, which I think are significant to that question.
I thought you agreed that she was an employee but not a part-time or full-time employee, or am I misstating that?
Your Honor, she was not a full-time or part-time employee, certainly. If you
wasn't even an employee at all?
She was not an employee at all. She was stated to be an employee of Progressive. If there was a test, if this was a case
of... You can be an employee of two different entities, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
There's no question she was an employee of Progressive. No one disputes that. The question is, was she an employee of the hospital? How do you define employee then? How do you define employee?
The contract defined employee as full-time or part-time. Your Honor, to go specifically to your question, if we were deciding whether the hospital could be vicariously liable because of some control under a master-servant analysis, then yes, she would be found to be. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the terms of the contract and risk allocation negotiated between two sophisticated parties. By its clear language, the Green Spring policy only provided insurance to full-time and part-time employees.
But aren't there, I thought there was case law suggesting that insurance contracts like this, or at least there's no case law suggesting that the term full-time or part-time employee excludes temporary or leased employees in a situation like this, right?
Full-time and part-time have common, popular, ordinary meanings, and that is under the rules of construction.
Why doesn't part-time cover temporary?
Because part-time employees are on a set schedule, which is less than full-time. In other words, they come on a regular schedule, but they are part-time. They do not work. They work less than 35 hours, according to the Bureau of Labor. But they work on a regular schedule. This is a per diem employee. Per diem employees are very common in the healthcare industry. They come for a shift as assigned by their actual employer, in this case, Progressive. They are not a part-time employee that works on a regular shift.
They sound like a borrowed employee. Doesn't it fit the definition of borrowed employee under Black's Law Dictionary?
Under the master-servant test, Your Honor, I think that's closer to the mark. Yes, a borrowed employee.
But you're just saying that test is just, we shouldn't look to it at all.
No, Your Honor, you should not. And for the reasons that full-time and part-time
if we disagreed with you and thought the language of the staffing agreement was, or the language of the agreement was ambiguous, what do we do then?
Your Honor, it's very clear what
we looked at the reasonable expectations of the parties, right?
Exactly. The parties to the insurance contract.
And so what do we learn from that?
There is evidence in the record in the form of a declaration from Larry Smith, the Vice President of Risk Management of MedStar and a officer of Greenspring. And
that's a subjective understanding. Where do we look for reasonable expectations?
Your Honor, I think you look at the plain language for reasonable expectations. Full-time and part-time, ordinary...
It's a little bit circular. If I'm saying the plain... If we think it's ambiguous, and I know you disagree with that. You don't want us to think that. But let's imagine we disagree with you. We think it's ambiguous. Now we're looking at reasonable expectations of the parties. Where do we look to?
Your Honor, you look at the parties first and how they were situated. We have, on the one hand, a hospital which contracts with a nursing agency. And in the agreement with the nursing, with the temporary agency, it specifically negotiates and the nursing agency agrees to procure insurance on behalf of the leased workers. Yeah. And for the reasonable expectation.
And what type of insurance was that, primary or excess?
Interstate was a primary policy. It's only excess if the other insurance clause is enforced. Mm-hmm. So it's a primary policy for which Interstate accepted premiums specifically to ensure the conduct of the temporary workers of Progressive. And in this case, Progressive not only agreed to procure insurance to cover its leased workers, but it also agreed to indemnify the hospital for any claims arising from the negligence of the workers.
What's your response to the fact that the settlement agreement answers your question about indemnification and allocation? That one looks at the settlement agreement, it sure looks on its face, if we go back to a plain language argument, as if it eliminates an indemnity claim and undercuts your argument there. What's your response to that?
The settlement agreement identifies Interstate as the insurer of Progressive and Nurse Hand, mm-hmm. who is bound to pay claims that are made against Progressive and Nurse Hand. There was an indemnity claim by the hospital and MedStar, by the hospital against Nurse Hand and and Progressive. And consideration was paid to release those claims. That doesn't mean the claims weren't there or that the decision is made now after the fact that the hospital did not have a valid indemnification claim against Nurse Hand or that Interstate, in the first instance, insured the contractual liability for indemnification agreements that Progressive entered into. In this case, that's exactly what happened. Interstate insured not just the negligence, but also the contractual liability for indemnification.
Why would we have a different rule in the vicarious liability context than in this context for what the term, or why, more accurately, why would DC have a different
rule? Your Honor, because those are test for two different things. One is a tort test for vicarious liability.
I understand that, but tell me why it makes sense to have different definitions other than that they're different things. I get that.
Well, yeah. I suppose that that is the reason that they would be different, Your Honor. One is, what did the parties to the contract contract for? Full-time and part-time employees. Those are those who are intended to be insured. And Mr. Smith, in his declaration, stated the reason for that. It's a risk management decision. The hospital is able to screen the employees it hires. It relies on Progressive to screen its temporary employees. And there is a this is also indication of the reasonable expectations of the
this,
parties.
This must happen all the time in the industry.
Generally, insureds who the insurers of temporary agencies don't claim that they're not its insurer. So, in fact, it doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Or at least people are going to write it in now. Right.
They may, Your Honor. Your Honor,
the leading insurance treatise, which is cited in the red brief at 27, considers these kinds of employees, borrowed employees, to be covered within the definition of employee in insurance contracts. Isn't that something that informs the reasonable expectations?
Your Honor, the reasonable expectations of these parties, when all the documents are considered, are pretty clear. And that is that Progressive would provide insurance for its leased employees, and that the hospital would provide insurance for its actual full-time and part-time employees. Your Honor, I'd like to touch on the equities just briefly. And that is that the equities in this case favor that Interstate provide insurance for the employment, that for the leased employee for which it agreed to provide insurance, and that this burden not be shifted to the hospital, that specifically negotiated with Progressive, Interstate's insured, that Interstate and or that Progressive and its insurer would cover claims for negligence for the leased employee. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Paulette Sarp, and I represent the appellee in this matter, Interstate Fire and Casualty Company. The way I would like to start my argument is to refocus it. What we have here is an insurance dispute between two insurance companies, Greenspring Financial and Interstate. That is the only claim before this court. It's one for equitable contribution. And that, according to the D.C. authority that we cite, is governed by the policy's other insurance clause. This goes on in the industry all the time. Insureds are covered by multiple policies. This is not unique. And when what the court does when you have that issue is look at the other insurance clauses. My policy, my client's policy, says it's excess. That's the insurance we agreed to provide, not primary. Greenspring provides primary explicitly for its employees. That's a no-brainer under the rules that apply to reconciling other insurance clauses. There's no conflict there. Sometimes you have excess versus excess, and the courts do have to look outside the policy for rules to say, well, what happens when they both say they're excess? Somebody's got to pay. That's not the case here. It's really simple. Greenspring is not happy with the policy that it drafted, and it's asking the court to go backwards and look at what the parties meant when they were drafting, what this underlying contract says or was negotiated. That is completely irrelevant. If the policy is unambiguous, that's what you look at. And as far as the other insurance, you know, who's primary, who's excess, even Greenspring doesn't dispute that those two policy provisions, when you put them together, are crystal clear. If Nurse Hand wasn't insured under the Greenspring policy is primary. Interstate is excess. To the extent they're arguing there's an inequity here, we are at a loss. The inequity that is attempted to be, or the equities that the court looks at when resolving priority of coverages is, did one insurer pay under its policy when its policy said it shouldn't? That's the inequity, and the inequity here was foisted on Interstate, who promised only to pay excess.
Is your argument that she was a part-time employee?
Well, I don't know that it really matters. I mean, let's put it this way. The definitions that Greenspring cite, they focus heavily on the fact that their policy says we provide coverage for part-time or full-time employees. First of all, that doesn't explain what's an employee. you have to go outside and look at what an employee is. Employee is someone who's under the control.
Oh, wait a second. We know she's not a full-time employee.
Correct. Right. If you look at
so is she a part-time employee? And if she's not, aren't you in trouble?
If that's the definition you want to apply, the definitions they cite, Nurse Hand does qualify as a part-time employee. There's nothing in the definitions that they cite, which were Census Bureau, I think Bureau of Labor regulations. That's the only thing they cite for how you define a part-time and full-time. And clearly, all they say, it's based on the number of hours. If she works under 40, yeah, she's part-time. That would depend, I guess, on a weekly basis, how many hours she worked. Sometimes she might have worked more, sometimes she worked less. It certainly doesn't require, as Greenspring likes to read into the definition, that somehow that requires a schedule, that you have to be, on the schedule ahead of time. There's nothing in the definitions that say that. Part-time, full-time refers solely to the number of hours worked. She's one or the other, obviously, and it would have depended on how many hours she worked that week, and it's really irrelevant. The issue is, was she an employee? And an employee under D.C. law expressly includes, since it's well established,
part-time. I don't know that it's irrelevant. I mean, as I understand her argument, that there are other types of employees besides full-time and part-time employees, right? And she claimed that Nurse Hand fell into that category. So I think it's irrelevant. Your argument has to be that she's a part-time employee, right?
Sure. She's a part-time employee.
How do you define part-time employee then?
Well, if you look at the definitions they cite, it's purely based on the number of hours. Mm-hmm. The dividing line between, if you're a part-time, you work less than 40
right.
hours.
So it's an employee who's not full-time, right?
An employee can be full-time?
No, a part-time employee is an employee who's not full-time.
Correct. It's more a matter of exclusion.
Your point, it sounds like, is that part-time versus full-time goes to the number of hours.
Exactly.
Neither of them tells you what an employee is.
Exactly. It doesn't, and it's certainly the definitions they cite certainly don't write in this requirement that you have to be on a schedule basis. The point is, liability policies in the cases we cite, they cover employees, part-time or full-time, borrowed, temporary, seasonal, whatever. They're intended to provide coverage to people for whom the named insured can be responsible for. And no one is disputing. I really don't think Greenspring in their briefs, they sort of suggest now that she wasn't under their control. But there is no dispute that she was under their control. She was providing health care to the hospital's patients. I'm sure a patient would be dumbfounded to know that the hospital was not going to provide coverage for a nurse that was providing care to their loved one at the hospital. She was under their control. The district court clearly and correctly determined that the facts about who, they had a right to discharge her, which is a key element in determining employment status. That is really, I think, a given under the record. What Greenspring tries to argue is, yeah, we had the right to control her. We're liable for her negligence if she committed it while caring for our patients. But, our policy didn't specifically say borrowed employees, so we don't have a duty to cover. There's no case law in D.C. that would suggest that, especially in light of the fact that D.C. courts it's well established that this borrowed servant rule applies, and that's just a type of employee. If Greenspring, and we've cited case law in other jurisdictions, albeit not D.C., that specifically have interpreted that language, employee, in an insurance coverage case and said, yes, a reasonable interpretation of that includes borrowed employees. There's no authority to the contrary. And it makes sense if a temporary employer should be liable for and should provide coverage for people that are working under its control and supervision. If Greenspring had wanted to exclude leased employees, it could have. And in this case, that's especially significant because Greenspring is a captive insurer. It's not a State Farm. It's not American Family. Greenspring writes insurance only for the hospital and MedMart. They know what the situation is.
Let me ask you a question. Why in the world did Interstate agree to pay the bulk of this settlement with the
Your Honor, we have good faith. I understand that. We have good faith obligations to our insured, Nurse Hand. She's our insured, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not, I wasn't fully privy to all the negotiations in the underlying case. But we have an obligation, if we can, to settle claims against our insureds if it's doable for a reasonable amount, and then reserve so that they're out of the fray and their exposure is limited. That's what we did. And Greenspring was fully aware of this. As one of your honors pointed out, the settlement agreement specifically says we're getting rid of all these other arguments, the liability against the plaintiff, the cross claims for indemnity. The only issue that's left now is which insurance company is going to pay for Nurse Hand's liability. You both insure, who's going to pay? And it specifically says that in the settlement agreement. So there's no surprise, no inequity here. The parties eliminated all the other issues about who should have been paying for, you know, what.
But if you knew you were excess and they were primary, that's a strange way to do it, isn't it? I mean,
I don't think
you
it is.
You sort of served as primary here, right, in the settlement?
Because we still have a direct obligation to our insurer. We can't say, because ultimately we're going to be excess as far as any indemnity payments, you're on your own insurer. We can't do that. We still have a duty to indemnify and to defend, and that's what we did, and leave the insured out of that and then go at it with another insurance company. So that happens all the time. I've got lots of contribution cases where that's the case. We settle underlying case and we resolve the dispute with the other insured. And so I don't really have anything else to add unless your honors have some questions.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll give you back a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will be brief. Your Honor, just to be clear, the interstate policy is a primary policy. It's excess only if this other insurance clause comes into play.
But it does have another insurance clause.
It does indeed. And as Interstate just conceded during its argument, that if Nurse Hand is an insured under the Greenspring policy, then the other insurance clause comes into play. So the first question is, that we come back to, is Nurse Hand an insured under the Greenspring policy? Because otherwise, the other insurance clause is completely irrelevant. And so the question is, does Nurse Hand qualify as a part-time employee under the Greenspring policy? The cases that Interstate has cited in which borrowed servants were found to be employees for the purpose of this type of analysis, none of them contain the full-time and part-time qualifier. These are adjectives, modifiers that can't be read out of the policy, as Interstate would like this court to do. Those cases that Interstate cites are any employee or an employee. That's not the Greenspring language. Greenspring language is limited to full-time or part-time, and that language cannot be read out of policy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Case is submitted.